And welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power, and we shine a light ahead of us to the path where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together. That is, to address problems instead of defending positions. Now, it may seem unusual on a show supposedly about politics that we address what would seem to be religious or spiritual matters. Maybe it's because people look at our current political, new word, situation, and say, God help us! Well, last week we interviewed Rabbi Rami Shapiro about perennial wisdom, the common foundation that seems to underlie, or better yet, under truth, every religious, spiritual, or ethical path. Well, this week on Wiki, we'll be featuring one of the most heralded and widely read ancient texts of all, the Bhagavad Gita. Written more than 2,000 years ago, the Gita, Bhagavad Gita meaning divine song, speaks to and accesses that perennial wisdom that I just mentioned. Deepak Chopra has called the Gita, quote, the ultimate guide for your spiritual journey. Our guest this week, Dr. Isaac Bentwich, is a longtime practitioner. He's an MD and a longtime practitioner and teacher of yoga and meditation. He's a physician and a scientist. He's founded three life science technology companies, leading revolutions in medicine, genomics, and environment conservation. He's now the head of Innovation Center at Technion in Haifa, Israel, recognized as one of the top 10 innovative universities in the world. He says that vision and innovations that underlie the companies he founded came through periods of silent meditation retreats at the foothills of the Himalayas and the Galilee. His path is one of reverence to the wisdom teachings that shine through different religions and traditions. The study and practice of Gita's wisdom, he says, has profoundly touched his life. He's passionate about sharing this with others, and his work on this particular translation of the Gita covered a 12-year period. So, welcome, Isaac.
Hi, Steve. Pleased to be here.
Good. Okay, quick, we'll get right into it. Why the Bhagavad Gita, and why now?
Well, like you mentioned, the Bhagavad Gita is an ancient text considered right up there alongside the Bible and the Quran. It is long considered one of the most trusted guides for inner development, meditation, and happiness. So that's as for the question of why Bhagavad Gita. It really is. Different people have viewed it in different ways. You can look at it as a piece of poetry or literature. You can look at it from the perspective of history and culture. But for me and for many, I think it is really a practical guide on one's inner journey. And as such, it has made a profound difference in my life, and one which I'm passionate sharing with others. Why now? I believe now more than ever. We live in a time and a generation where the discord in general and the and in particular the discord between the spiritual and the material is a confusion and a conflict which we all feel, and it reverberates through the various discords that we see around us. And so going back to this ancient well of wisdom seems to me to be more timely now than ever.
Well, you know, interestingly, you mentioned this discord or distrust or conflict between the scientific material and the spiritual religious, and it seems like you've managed to bridge that gap as a scientist, as a physician. What came first, the science or the spirituality with you? How did you come to weave these together?
That's a good question. I have no presumptions to have bridged the gap or to have attained any special attainments. I will say that the spirituality has been something that I was born with and came with my mother's milk and with my grandfather's love. I was born in the Jewish tradition and have a very strong connection there. Later on, was fortunate to be attracted and have a high reverence to Christianity, to other religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam. So I definitely would not say that I'm of the class of people that were called scientists and then gradually warmed up. I think both of these have evolved side by side from my childhood. Both my parents are physicians. Our home nurtured curiosity and boldness, and so I don't think that there's ever been a conflict in my mind between the two. I've not felt one.
That's really interesting. Of course, the jokey part of myself would love to say that having two parents who are physicians, that's a paradox. But we won't say that. So you've obviously grown up with all of these traditions. It's interesting. One of the people I interviewed last year, Philip Goldberg, wrote a book called American Veda, and he talks about how in some ways there. Jewish people tend to be attracted to the Vedas, to Vedic philosophy, and I don't know what it is, but this seems to be in that tradition. How did you come to specifically get interested in Vedic philosophy and then consequently to Bhagavad Gita?
Well, speaking of humor, you know, the funny thing is that is the story of how I came across the Gita specifically. I'll take you on a short time travel. I was in my second year of medical school. There was a yoga a teacher's training course held in the summer between on the summer vacation. It was a month-long intensive course. You'd have to be pretty crazy to take a month during the test exam period. And my mother, bless her soul, passed away 3 years ago, was crazy enough and to be the anti-typical Jewish mom. I came and said, hey, you know, there's this course. Of course I can't do it because it's right in the middle of the exams. And she said, Isaac, you go do it and you'll be relaxed enough and focused enough. Then in a few hours a day between the lessons, you'll be able to do the exams. This is the exams then were such that you really study, I don't know, 18 hours a day and barely do it. So it was pretty crazy. Digressing a bit, but back to the point, it was a very meaningful course for me. I loved everything. The yoga, the meditation, a little bit of philosophy. I came there because of the yoga. I wanted to get, I was teaching yoga already, and I wanted to perfect or to improve my act. And hearing that there is some meditation and philosophy, I said, okay, that should be nice. The only thing that I really hated was the Gita. There was many subject studies, and that's the one that I used to joke about the Indian quirks and wait impatiently for the classes to be over because I didn't connect at all to this mythological dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna and the Indian mythology. I had very strong connection to my Jewish roots and to other religions as well, and didn't connect to it. And it's only later that I really fell in love with the Gita. So that's how it all began.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because I'm sure that some people listening are familiar with it, and many are not. So what is the basic story of the Bhagavad Gita, and why it's particularly relevant in these times?
Right. So the interesting thing about the Gita is that which is underneath the story, and in fact, even within the Gita itself, the story, the framework story, occupies just a thin layer at the beginning and the end. And the story is as follows. It's a dialogue between an Indian prince called Arjuna and his teacher, who is his friend and his charioteer, and no less than God incarnate. And even from this, you can almost say comic outset, you know, it's like, how about having a friendly afternoon chat with God? Would you like to be able to sit and have that chat? Say, God, what is this crazy world about? Why am I unhappy? What does it all mean? What do I do tomorrow morning? What is wisdom? What is happiness? What are the different paths? Tell me. I want to understand. That's the framework of the Gita. Now, the thing is that this dialogue takes place in what seems at first blush as the least likely of settings. Prince Arjuna is attacked by vicious family members who are out to kill him. He needs to fight a defensive war, and being a pacifist, which surely we can all identify with, he is reluctant to fight and has a problem avoiding fighting, and so he's perplexed and distressed, and in his distress turns to his friend and mentor and charioteer, mind you. So he is the boss of his teacher, who is God incarnate. To put it even more extreme, visualize the picture. The armies are gathered before a bloody battle. He asks his charioteer, please put me between the armies so that I can see my friends and family on both sides. And then dramatic freeze frame. Everything freezes, and within this freeze frame, just as the battle is about to ensue, begins this dialogue of the meaning of life and the path to happiness. So this is not Jesus on the Mount of Beatitude. It's not the Buddha in Sarnath with the Four Noble Truths under a shaded tree, or in Bodh Gaya waking up to realization in the midst of a battle. Is that where you have a philosophical discussion? You betcha. That's the only place you have a philosophical discussion, because unlike what we in the Western world have been accustomed to, view philosophy as some sort of intellectual jewel, that's not at all what it is. It is the ultimate no bullshit, no BS dialogue about the most profound questions that are there, which happens at this eye-level dialogue and with the urgency and simplicity that only such an extreme setting can have. And lastly, it's also extremely fitting for our generation and time right now. We're all in one sort of fight or another constantly. These are sometimes pleasant, important, positive fights, but life is a struggle in life, in marriage, in relationships, in parenting, in career, in spirituality. We struggle. And so it puts us immediately where we should be, understanding that it's not some faraway dialogue or historical book. It's actually an autobiography, our autobiography, your, mine. It is a dialogue that speaks to us directly, and it is a dialogue between us and the inner voice of our soul.
Very, very, very pertinent, very interesting. Of course, you know, these days, as you said, you know, there's a lot of people who, you know, are reluctant to fight, who don't believe in violence, who are pacifists, and yet there is an attack. There's currently an attack on the goodness that we imagined we've been living for all of these years. We've got, you know, the Donald Trump figure. Symbolic figure up in our face, and there's a lot of battlefield stuff going on. So it'll be very interesting when we get back from our break to talk about how that book can help us through this particular battle. I'm talking with Dr. Isaac Bentwich. We're talking about the Bhagavad Gita. This is Steve Behrman. We'll be back after these messages.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Okay, Steve Behrman, we're back with Isaac Bentwich, MD. We're talking about the Bhagavad Gita and his long-term, lifelong almost, relationship with this book. But before we address your own personal story, how and why you spent 12 years on the translation, let's focus a bit on how this story, this battlefield story, this freeze-frame battlefield story, can guide us through the times we're facing right now.
Well, that's a great question, and really in the spirit of the Gita itself, of beginning with the down to earth, immediate questions that we confront, and using that as the place to place our ladder, as it were, on our journey inwards and upwards. In a sense, you mentioned the struggle that we feel in our lives, in politics, and so forth. This is not dissimilar to the situation the prince has confronted, and so the answer that the Gita has is striking but uplifting. You see, the prince goes to his master and says, "I don't know what to do. I'm being attacked. I'm reluctant to fight, but I know that I cannot not fight. What should I do? This dilemma is tearing me apart." And the answer of the teacher, of the inner voice of our soul, is striking. It is basically saying, "You've got it all wrong, mate. It's not a question should I fight or should I not fight, but a much more profound question: who am I and what is my motivation?" And getting clarity on both of these, the external actions that we need to take, and we do need to take them, are secondary almost. In other words, the Gita draws our uses the struggle that we find outside to draw our attention to the real battle, which is the battlefield of the soul, between the material side in us and the spiritual side in us. We tend to think of things externally. Even when we think of spirit and matter, we say, "Oh yeah, we're living in this time. There's the Donald Trumps of the world, and there's the spirits in the world, and this is something external." And again, the Gita gently, lovingly pulls our awareness and attention inwardly. This is nothing is external, says the Gita. Look inward and you will see the Donald Trump within you. You will see the Democrat or the Republican or whatever within you. Make peace in your soul, and then from this point of wisdom and peace, go and act in the world. It's not at all in disregarding the external world. We have a duty to perform, each of us, including our duties to act in the world around us. But it will be confused and not charged with enough energy if we're not coming from a place of clarity that understands that the main struggle is an internal one and not external.
You know, so much of what some wise guy said years ago, that spirituality is our connection with the divine and religion is crowd control. And and in that regard, you know, we see people who are on crusades of various kinds, completely convinced that they're right, and they tend to project the enemy out there. And so much of what we've had as religion has tended to project that the other out there. You know, it's like that wonderful song by the Austin Lounge Lizards, kind of tongue-in-cheek song, "Jesus loves me, but he can't stand you," you know. So so basically, how does this – how can this – I would call it an enlightened view of the internal and the external. How can this make its way into the world and begin to soften some of those hard positions that people are holding on to, I think, out of fear?
Yeah. You know, it's not a coincidence. The Gita has three paths, which I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about: the path of action, path of devotion, and path of wisdom. And these are successive steps on our inner journey. And so it begins with an emphasis on how do we act in the world, which is what we discussed now. But interestingly enough, before the beginning, like a sneak preview, before focusing on the path of action of how do we act in the world now, tomorrow, what do I do next? There's this, actually, I call it a pull of the rug under the feet of the prince. And let me read, if I may, a few verses that sort of speak the Gita's voice directly, and it also gives you a sense of the melodiousness of these pearls of wisdom in rolling in your mind. And so, like us, like your question, we ask ourselves, what should we do now about politics, about these struggles, etc. And the prince says, after describing this dilemma that he has, should I fight, should I not fight, he begins by standing on a stump and giving a big speech, which sounds okay, until he comes to the point of breaking down and saying, I don't know. And it is then that his heart is open for answers. And so he says, a veil of pity routs my heart. Mind's dark. Where does my duty lay? Guide me, Master. What ought I do? I'm your disciple. Show me the way. Not all the riches of earth known or attaining God's heavenly throne can ease the grief that numbs my senses, remove this sorrow I've known. And then thus spoke the brave warrior prince, conqueror of sleep, master of will. I shall not fight, he added, and then spoke no more and was still. Then to him, between the two armies, disconsolate by these tormenting trials, the master, ruler of senses, spoke, wearing the faintest of smiles. And you see the master there with his Buddha-like faint smile. What are you smiling? My life is in a mess. This is tragedy. How can you be smiling? And the master says, and this is why I wanted to read these verses, you speak words of wisdom, O prince, but your sorrow is in vain. For the truly wise never mourn, neither the living nor the slain. There was never a time we were not, me or you or these enemy kings, nor can there be any future in which we ever cease being. The masters, the beautiful poetry, and even more powerful wisdom. The disciple, like us, is saying, tell me, A or B, should I do this or that? What should I do about my enemies? And the answer that shatters the very foundation of ego and intellect in our world says, hey, dude, you're not this body or mind. You think you are. The distinction that you see between you and your enemy, I am right, he is wrong, we are both bodies and mind, we are not, we are separate. You're not this body or mind, you are life itself in which all of this emerges. So, we can read on, but anyway, that I thought I'd give a tasting of this shattering of the basic paradigm from which we go back down to earth of how do I enact this in my life, or what do I do about the battle? Because the battle doesn't go away just by understanding this, but this is sort of going back to first principle, if you will, as far as the logic of it is concerned.
You know, that's really very, very powerful, because, again, we are in a world where we are thrown to all of these dualities. It's this or that, chocolate or vanilla, Democrat or Republican, right. You're with us or against us. And essentially, to be in the world but not of it, to be able to...
That's exactly right. If the Gita was written today, I'm just making this up here, but,
yeah.
If the prince would say, I'm a Democrat and I have this vicious Republican government, or if he was a Republican saying that I have this degraded, morally Democrat, and you turn to the voice inside, remember, this is not some wise God, wrathful God on a cloud, nor is it a guru outside. This is the inner voice of your soul. We turn to the inner voice of our soul wanting to, looking for encouragement for an opinion that we have. It is a noble opinion. We're very attached to it. And so it is shattering to hear the response, Republican, Democrat. You are not this body or your mind. Democrat and Republic are notions in the mind. You are not that. You are that which is beyond and underlying these apparent differences. The differences themselves do not exist, and so it's not a question of who is right. In the partial relative world, of course, there are differences, and we should take a stance, and we should do this and not that, and we go to the we go out and vote, of course, so we act. The Gita is not saying go to a cave in the Himalayas or the Galilee or the Blue Mountain or the Rockies and detach yourself from the world. No, you have a duty to perform in the world, but let's first get to a point of clarity and the connection to that which we are. You are life itself. You are consciousness itself, in which all of these are waves that come up and subside.
You know, that's like the, in a certain regard, life is a dream. And just as people have done dream analysis, say that all of the elements that you find in your dream, they're all parts of your own psyche and consciousness. So projecting that outward or inward in this case, that's all of the things we see in the world are really part of our inner consciousness. Now, that's kind of a hard thing for the Western mind to grasp. But I think that, just as you've said it, of course, it makes tremendous sense. I'm curious, though, how, the work that you've done, the inventions and innovations, what's the relationship between your meditation, so to speak, and these bright ideas that have emerged? Talk a little bit more about your own experience working with the Gita and with other with meditation to bring forth things in the practical world.
Yeah. Look, every one of us who has had at least some experience with meditation, even if it is not in the formal sense of meditation, even if you're jogging or cycling or swimming or doing the dishes, and as you do so, letting the body get into this cyclic action and letting the mind relax and sink into the quietude that underlies the thought, we realize that that it's really true that we are not the thoughts. We're generally so engrossed in this cloud of thought that we get sucked into the illusion that our thoughts and opinions and memories and emotions are who we are. Practice of meditation and the wisdom of the Gita have really connected well, powerfully into this, and touched the science and the practical life of my day job, if you will. Every one of the three, I've founded and led three companies. Each one was an exciting journey of 7 to 10 years. of a great team of people working together in medicine, in genomics, in the, conservation. It so happens that each of these journeys, coincident or not, began with a meditation silent retreat with prayer and meditation and practice and yoga in its broader view, anywhere between 6 weeks to 3.5 months. The innovations that came through the silence during these periods ended up being powerful patents and the source of both the technology that evolved and formed the basis of these companies, of course, a large group of people, very talented, very dedicated, working together, and the friendship, camaraderie between us that resulted in these results. So I'm not saying that this is all or mostly me, but my part did come through these periods of meditation. I mentioned this in the context of what I said earlier of this cloud of thought, in that and tied it to the experience we all have jogging, etc. When you quiet the mind, intuition blossoms. The powerful answers in life often do come from this well of silence that's underlying it. And so when you using various techniques, quiet the mind and listen, it's like putting it differently. I would say that the inventions that came through me were much more about listening than thinking. And that is something that is open to all of us, and which the Gita facilitates, I think.
How do you experience what they call that still small voice? I mean, did these ideas come as just like a little seedling of an idea, or did they come fully blown as here is your next assignment?
I do not mean to say this in any metaphysical sense of, you know, God spoke to me or I heard his voice. That's hasn't happened to me, but I will say that I've worked for 3 decades very intensely with my intellect, and it has become a sharpened tool. But through this work, I've also learned about its limitations. The real ideas, the breakthroughs, are things that come from silence within, and not by a dual or a swashbuckling of intellect. Intellect then is used to perfect them and to work on them. Anyway.
Very good. Well, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back with to talk more about the Gita and specifically this translation with Dr. Isaac Bentwich. Steve Behrman, this is Wiki Politiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network. Presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Well, we're back with our final segment with Dr. Isaac Bentwich, MD. I'm talking about his journey with the Bhagavad Gita, and this is very curious to me. You've spent 12 years working on this particular translation, and the idea behind this has to do with this being an epic poem that has that is musical, and perhaps in the rhythm of the words and how they're formatted, that actually brings forth that other voice that's other than the intellect. So talk more about how you got into the journey of making this translation and how it relates to the musicality of the poem.
Yeah. So as you mentioned in your introduction, Steve, literally Bhagavad Gita means divine song. For many years, but for most people, through most translations until now, and there are about 200 different translations into English alone, and many hundreds of commentaries, because it's such a profound and not renowned book. Usually, because it deals with these profound questions of life, the meaning of life, the paths to happiness, and so forth, it's a very precise and very profound spiritual, philosophical in a practical sense, manuscript. And so the emphasis has been on it as a text more than as a poem. So as not to, sugarcoat it and put it in a poem format, missing the subtleties and the accuracy of the of this profound manuscript. Think of it, on the funny side, being a physician, it often seems to me that the accuracy of the Gita is like a neurosurgeon's manual to the way our mind works. It truly is very, very accurate. Now think of a neurosurgeon's manual in poem form. That's almost sort of funny, and trying to translate it as such is perhaps not funny as far as the results one would get in one's surgery. So. But yes, as I translated it, it's only after years of being involved with this text, and I started translating verses simply because not out of an intention to do a translation, but just out of my sadhana or my spiritual practice, jotting down verses that moved me, first translating them into my mother tongue of Hebrew, which took 7 years, and then another 5 years of recasting them in English. As I did so, I gradually got the sense of the sleekness, the smoothness, the elegance of the verses. They've been likened to Pearls of Wisdom, and the 700 verses to a necklace of 700 pearls, each connected to the pearl before and after it, and them being smooth enough to roll around in your mind and do their thing. And this is actually a very accurate description, I find. They do roll around. I mean, look, we all do this every day. There's a Tibetan teacher, Lama Yeshe, who I admire, and he once said, you don't need to think whether you should be using a mantra or not. You're using mantras anyway. Currently, your mantra is pizza, 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 or money, money, money. Let's change that into something more meaningful. Similarly, with the music of the verses of the Gita, you know, we're currently, every advertiser is using it, and we're currently stuck with these jingles swirling in our mind and doing their thing, which is not that useful. So replacing this with these pearls of wisdom really is powerful. Interestingly enough, it's only after years of being involved with it since the whole process was like peeling layers of an onion, of gently taking layers of mythology and terminology and doing so as carefully as I can to remain accurate to the meaning, the deep meaning of each verse, but without requiring others to study all of the commentaries which one needs to study and bringing it back to the direct eye-level dialogue. As I was doing so, gradually I started hearing the music of it, and then this is a bit weird, but it's true that as I started translating it in more formal a poem-like, and I was attracted to the format of four lines in each verse, and ultimately it turned out that that's the exact meter in which the Gita was, the near exact meter in which the Gita was written, and out of my ignorance, I didn't know it. And so I then rebrushed the translation to this format of eight syllables in each of four lines. And after I've done that, I could really hear the music playing and could see that in some cases you need to ease the syllable count in order to let the Gita sing. And so that was a journey of discovery. But beyond my personal story, you just let them roll in your mind, and you can actually feel it. Perhaps tying to your previous question and to you know, we spoke about these high and lofty things of you're not the body, you're not the mind, you're life itself, and we're sort of stuck if that's all we have to go on, because, you know, there's still Republican and Democrat and crisis and mortgages to pay, and what do we do now? And so the Gita begins with this path of action, and to demonstrate the music, let me read two verses that speak about this, but you can now hear it with the music. And it's talking about how should we act in the world, with the message being, let us all try to act, letting God or life act through us, rather than being captivated by the false notion of the ego, I am acting and I am doing this for a result, rather than let life enact itself through me. And here are two beautiful verses that say, desires aside, all actions and offering, the wise rests on action, by action untainted. Like a pure lotus leaf in muddy waters, resting on water, remaining not wetted. For action yogi is unattached, mind, body, senses are but tools. Actions purify their heart springs. They know I act not, they're not fooled. So you get this feeling of this magical, this magic that's really within these verses. these imagery that's used and the music that's there, if you read it once, it goes through one ear and passes through the other, but as you let it roll in your mind and meditate on it, it really leads to a profound change. And as these verses point the way, use daily life itself. Use the conflict outside of Democrat and Republican and the elections and all of that. Use that as a vehicle for inner growth and spirituality, which is really profound, I think.
You know, this is really interesting. I love the idea that without knowing exactly what the rhythm was in doing that deep, attentive listening that you did through the barriers of language, et cetera, the appropriate rhythm, the appropriate meter, it asserted itself and came through. And, you know, so many of this is certainly true of Hebrew, you know, and Sanskrit, both being ancient languages, that there's something in the sound of the words that evoke something that's you know, way more fundamental than the meaning. And so you're able somehow to get this rhythm through the fog of different languages, and it's kind of like a fundamental truth asserting itself through that. So to me, I just wanted to highlight that's really a very special way of truth coming through that's beyond the actual language. What is the exact? I want to give people the exact name of your translation, and we'll on the website we'll have a link to where people can buy the book. But give us the name of the book, your translation.
So the book is called Gita, A Timeless Guide for Our Time. And it is actually just been launched these past days and is available on the Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other booksellers in Kindle, paperback, and hardcover formats, and audiobook is being released in the next days or so.
You know, there's one more thing that I saw in your press release that was interesting to me, and it said that the Gita, and certainly your translation of it, is quote unquote woman empowering, and crafted for both men and women. Say more about the woman empowering aspect of it.
Yeah, this was very important for me. The Gita is this long dialogue with a description that includes very beautiful poetic descriptions of the yogi ideal. What should one aspire to? Ask the prince. Tell me what a yogi looks like. Tell me what I should, by looking at that example, I can identify it and try to enact it in my life. And in the regular translations, this is all worded in male form. The yogi, he thinks, he accepts pleasure and pain equal-mindedly. His home is everywhere and nowhere. All of these are beautiful things, but you know, I thought that I feel very strongly that in our time, more than ever before, women play a central role in spirituality, leadership, yoga, and otherwise, and the fact that this is not crafted or worded in male form is really out of place, especially since the Gita has this beyond the body, beyond the gender, etc. Message. And so this is the only translation or the first translation that is crafted such that it's gender neutral. And so it speaks directly to men and women alike. Just one curiosity relating to this, the Gita was originally written 2,500 years ago, and so in its practical direct sense, there's only one verse that that relates to women, and it's in a derogatory sense of those unfortunate beings born as women or untouchables or something like that, and so I took the liberty of modifying it to the true essence of the Gita, which permeates through everything of you're not this gender or body or memories, you are spirit itself.
Again, everything is really always based in the limitations of the culture and language of the time.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
Clearly that, and you've upgraded it and updated it for that. And again, as you say, we're really ultimately none of these things that we appear to be, and yet we have to fully embody whatever that is in order to get the richness of the life experience. Et cetera. I'm very much looking forward to seeing your version. I may be able to get down to see you in my neighborhood on Friday if we haven't left for our trip yet. Anything else that you want to add, Isaac, in relation to this book and perhaps where you see it going from here on in? You're just launching it. It's a new child that's just entered the world. What are your aspirations for this kid that you just hatched?
Well, you know, I say that through these years of working with the Gita, I've become infatuated and deeply connected to each of the 700 verses. It's now going out into the world to do its good for others. You're welcome to enjoy, and since it's not backed by any big publisher, please do share and with others. And if you want to join the book reading at Book Passage in San Francisco this
good.
Friday.
Good. We will actually have that on our site. Thank you so much, Isaac Bentwich, talking about the Bhagavad Gita. This is Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We'll catch you next week.